This is Free Speech Radio News for December 22nd. I'm Matt Martin. Coming up...
People over there know very well that George Bush and Dick Cheney both have made public statements about withdrawing troops from Bosnia, withdrawing troops from Kosovo. That is very good news for people within Serbia.
International views of the prospects for a Bush foreign policy. In California, consumers and utilities show down over electric rates. Critics charge that international aid agencies faked a famine. And more than 500 listeners at Pacifica Radio's New York station picket the corporate law offices of one of the foundation's board members. President-elect George W. Bush this week took major steps towards forming his foreign policy team, nominating retired General Colin Powell to be Secretary of State and naming Condoleezza Rice as his National Security Advisor. In the U.S., the appointments were noteworthy as part of Bush's effort to show the race and gender diversity of his closest advisors. But around the world, observers assess the changing of the guard for its potential to change their country's relations with the sole superpower.
Bush will focus his Latin American policy on Mexico because that's what he knows.
John Ross is Free Speech Radio News correspondent in Mexico City. He says Bush has many ties to Mexico through his family, his experience as a border state governor, and his dealings with newly elected Mexican President Vicente Fox.
Fox visited Bush in Texas in August. It gave Bush an opportunity to talk about his relations, his experience in foreign relations, which is not really very profound, but they seem to hit it off quite well. I think it's important to understand that every 12 years, Mexico and the U.S. elect a president together at the same time, simultaneously. And the last time this happened was George Bush and Carlos Salinas. So 12 years later, we see George W. Bush and Vicente Fox as being the two parallels.
But Ross also believes that new leadership won't have a profound effect on U.S.-Mexico relations.
The problems go way beyond the bureaucratic problems, way beyond the problems of personality and who's in power. These two countries are joined together in a very bad marriage. They're joined together at the border, 3,000 kilometers of difficult terrain, in which immigration and drugs, of course, are the main issues. Those are going to be the main issues, the main contradictions between the two cases, whether you have a Republican or Democratic person, whether you have Colin Powell or whoever as being Secretary of State, those problems are going to remain.
In Yugoslavia, Belgrade correspondent Jeremy Scahill says the U.S. election has not been front-page news. Instead, the focus has been on Yugoslavia's parliamentary election and the continuing process of rebuilding the nation's infrastructure. To the extent that Yugoslavians did concern themselves with the U.S. election, Scahill says they hoped that Al Gore, closely associated with the NATO bombing campaign against Serbia, would go down to defeat. And although Bush and Cheney are less familiar characters, Scahill says Yugoslavians will take their chances on the new administration.
People over there know very well that George Bush and Dick Cheney both have made public statements about withdrawing troops from Bosnia, withdrawing troops from Kosovo. That is very good news for people within Serbia. They do not want any foreign troops, certainly not United States troops, on their soil. So I think that they're really looking for a hands-off Yugoslavia policy from the Republicans.
While Yugoslavians hope the Bush administration will leave them alone, Free Speech Radio News Lagos correspondent Sam Olakoya says that that's just what Nigerians fear.
President Clinton did a lot in terms of improving Nigeria and the U.S. relationship. And many Nigerians feel that that tempo ought to continue. But with the Bush presidency, we feel that the tempo is going to go down. It will go back to square one.
Olakoya says Nigerians believe Republicans aren't interested in Africa and that they were unimpressed with Bush's father during his sole visit to the continent.
Nigerians remember that there was a little incident on that occasion. That was in Gambia. Masquerades were dancing in front of him in the normal, traditional African hospitality. They attempted to move closer to him, and on that occasion, Secret Service men guarding Bush went there and stopped the masquerades from moving close to him. That was during his father's presidency. It was a situation which many Nigerians were not very happy about. That what kind of a man is this that is so aloof from people?
Olakoya says Nigerians have followed the career of Colin Powell since the Gulf War and are proud that an African American has been nominated as Secretary of State. But although Condoleezza Rice is an African-American as well, she's also close to big oil, having served as a board member of Chevron, which named an oil tanker after her. Olakoya says those connections make her and the Bush administration suspect to many Nigerians.
Anybody seen to associate too much to the oil industry, to anybody seem to profiteer from the oil industry. It's not generally trusted by Nigerians.
Sam Olakoya is Free Speech Radio news correspondent in Lagos, Nigeria. George Bush's connections to the energy industry are not limited to oil. The top contributor to his presidential run was the CEO of Enron, one of the nation's major electricity producers. Enron is one of a number of power producers making windfall profits from the electricity crisis in California. Electricity became a front-page issue in the state this summer when deregulation in the San Diego area caused rates there to triple. And in recent months, the still-regulated utilities in the rest of the state have demanded that they be allowed to raise rates dramatically in order to pay for what they say is the high market rate for power. Consumer groups say utilities and electricity producers are working together to withhold supplies and thereby justify rate increases. The California Public Utilities Commission is being pressured to pass an emergency rate increase. On Thursday, the commissioners said that such an increase is both inevitable and imminent. Consumer advocates say the move is unnecessary and procedurally illegal. From San Francisco, Kelly Ramirez files this report.
The state legislature unanimously passed an energy deregulation plan in 1996. The first phase of it took effect this summer in San Diego. Electric bills doubled and tripled in a few months. Now the entire state is feeling the crunch as power reserves are dwindling. Producers are reaping record profits, most notably Williams, Reliant, and Texas-based Enron, whose CEO, Kenneth Lay, is on President-elect George W. Bush's short list for energy secretary. California's two major utilities, Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, and Southern California Edison, are trying to pass high wholesale energy costs onto consumers, despite a rate freeze in effect under the state's 1996 deregulation law. Shortly before the December 21st regular meeting of the PUC, several consumer advocates held a news conference to denounce the utility's claims of financial distress. Matthew Friedman, staff attorney for TURN, the Utility Reform Network, says the utilities are substantially inflating their claims of loss.
Remember, the utilities own a substantial amount of power plants in California. They supply 60 to 80% of the power they need for their own customers. They've been selling that power into the market at very high prices, pocketing the money, and then buying that power back and asking consumers to pay for the full purchase cost. The second thing is that they're not looking at the profits of the parent corporation. The parent corporation, for example, of Southern California Edison, reported its highest quarterly profits in corporate history in the third quarter of 2000. Their holding companies, their parents, and their unregulated affiliates have been making out like bandits these last few years at the expense of California consumers.
Harry Snyder, the senior advocate for Consumers Union, noted cartel activity at the wholesale producer level.
There are enough generators at the wholesale level to have competition if they chose to do that. But what's happening is the marketplace is working, greed is prevailing, and they're allowed to price signal. They look at what everybody else is selling for. They withhold power from the marketplace. They close down plants in sync for repairs, and they create a shortage.
Snyder outlined several near-term solutions he and other consumer advocates recently presented to California Governor Gray Davis.
The governor has a number of things he can do. One, he can force PG&E and Edison to sell their in-state generated power to the core customers, the homeowners and renters, at the cost of their production plus a reasonable profit. That will lower rates to California consumers. PG&E and Edison then can service their business clients as best they can, because the business community can protect themselves. Secondly, the governor needs to get together with the other western governors, western state governors, and agree amongst themselves not to bid up power. There is enough energy within all of the western states to supply our needs. Witness, the lights aren't going out. Thirdly, the governor has to guarantee our state energy sufficiency to meet all of the needs of the residents at the end of this process so we won't go through it again.
Snyder noted that the governor was, quote, intrigued by the proposals. During the public comment session of the PUC meeting, Robert Abraham, spokesperson for Lyndon LaRouche's FDR PAC, called for re-regulation.
We have been governed by policy axioms in this country, which really come out of the sort of Margaret Thatcher way of thinking. The free market, deregulation, privatization, we've seen it everywhere, trucking, airlines, we've seen it in the financial markets. That is all now coming home. We have to go back to a regulated economy and to policies which ensure the delivery of economic services, energy supplies, to the general public at large. That has to be the mandate of this commission.
The PUC intends to hold hearings in preparation for taking up the utility rate matter at its January 4th meeting. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelly O'Romaris in San Francisco.
After being held for over 3.5 years because of alleged ties to terrorism, Palestinian Mazen al-Najjar was released from incarceration late last Friday by Attorney General Janet Reno. The 43-year-old Palestinian cleric and university professor was detained by Immigration and Naturalization Service agents in 1997 for a visa violation, and then denied bail after an immigration judge heard secret evidence that was never shown to him or his attorneys. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
On his third day full of freedom after being held in a suburban Tampa jail for 3 years and 7 months, Mazen al-Najjar spoke to the press about his new life. Although he is happy to be with friends and family, he is also preparing for his next legal hurdle, a deportation hearing to be held next month. Al-Najjar is one of about 24 immigrants, almost all of them Muslims or Arabs, who have been detained on secret evidence. Since 1987, 18 such immigrants have been freed. Al-Najjar's sister, Nahlia al-Arian, earlier this year lobbied members of Congress to sponsor legislation banning the use of secret evidence. She says she and her family will continue to fight against its use.
And I want to express also our determination to repeal the use of secret evidence in America. We're going to start working very hard to do that. And our determination to prove to our fellow citizens that the American Muslim community is a patriotic community, a peaceful community, and you're going to see that very well, God willing, in the future.
Al-Najjar said that he doesn't have time for anger at the U.S. government. He also says he plans on being an activist for truth and an advocate for human dignity.
God willing, I'll be an advocate of the human dignity in every day of my life. Maybe before my incarceration, sometimes I had like low times where I thought that I should be less involved in the public affairs, less involved in the public interest. But now, no.
The INS's case revolved around al-Najjar's work with an Islamic think tank that the government said was a front for the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, a group listed by the U.S. as a Mideast terrorist group in 1996. Al-Najjar has steadfastly denied for 3.5 years that he has ever been associated with that terrorist group. He also says it's hard to fathom that he's been in prison for so long.
When I think how this could happen, 3 years and 7 months. That's a long time. Probably if someone could know in advance and tell me all that time will pass, probably I could have lost my patience. I could have lost my energy. I could have lost my determination.
At Monday's news conference, al-Najjar's brother-in-law, Sami al-Arian, said he wants the U.S. government to stop harassing him and other members of the Muslim community in Tampa.
The way they've been treating our community is reprehensible, to say the least. They have intimidated, harassed many of our community members. They tried to recruit them as informants. I don't think any other community would stand up for that. So we asked them to refrain from doing this. We are more than happy to sit with whoever wants to sit with us as a community and deal with whatever issues. But this campaign of harassment and intimidation that's been going on now for 5 years must stop. And I pray to God that they will stop it.
Al-Najjar's problems are not completely over. He will fight his order deportation in the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in January. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
In the spring of this year, the international media reported on a fast-developing food crisis in Ethiopia. Comparisons were frequently made to 1984, when mass starvation struck the country. Now that the year has passed in Ethiopia without famine, questions are being raised about just how serious the threat was to begin with and why aid organizations drew so much attention to it. From Addis Ababa, Rupert Cook has this investigative report.
Get in that casa.
What?
People queue patiently at a health clinic in the farming town of Nazareth, in central Ethiopia. Since 1991 and the end of the civil war between the Derg, a brutal Soviet-backed military dictatorship, and the now governing rebels, Ethiopia has made considerable progress in improving quality of life for its citizens. However, despite the advances in such areas as healthcare, security, and education, Ethiopia remains threatened by the spectres of drought and possible mass starvation. Just a few miles outside Nazareth, farmers are anxious about the unpredictable rains and worry about this year's meager crop. The country is still haunted by the time when millions starved during the terrible famine of 1984, its images of pot-bellied children dying in the dust seared into the global consciousness. However, although food shortages and drought remain a problem in several regions, as elsewhere in the Horn of Africa, some observers have criticized international NGOs and relief agencies for exaggerating the crisis as a means of attracting funds for their programs. In March and April, the world was told that Ethiopia faced a famine worse than the catastrophe of 1984. Film crews flew in and the emergency aid planes followed. Millions of dollars were donated to the relief effort and disaster apparently averted. Yet today, some claim that the crisis was hyped by the agencies and international media. Haile Kiros Gissasa is spokesperson for the Ethiopian government.
There was a drought this year in Ethiopia, but not to the extent that it was exaggerated by the NGOs and the UN. Of course, you know, the cause of this drought is natural, but actually it was controllable. We could have controlled it. The NGOs and UN groups, they just want to exaggerate it for the sake of their own interest. They live on it. I mean, I'm very sorry to say that there are some NGOs that are institutionalized for disaster. They came, they exaggerated it, then they, you know, they generated a lot of fund. I mean, the fund that was allocated now because of the exaggeration and the grain or the supplies that were distributed among the needy people, when you compare it, it's a drop in the ocean that has been distributed among the people.
A crucial difference between 1984 and the situation today, besides the end of the civil war, is the fact that in the intervening years, Ethiopia has created a system of food stocks throughout the country designed to prevent the eventuality of any repetition. Nevertheless, the agencies robustly reject the allegations of exaggeration. Rather, the warnings were justified, famine only narrowly averted. Bob McCarthy is head of emergency operations for UNICEF in Ethiopia.
They say that and they sound very cynical. The UN and the other international aid organizations have averted a famine in eastern Ethiopia. There is no doubt the situation was extremely serious. Women and children were affected. There are indications of unusually high mortality. We had a whole basket of problems that presented an extraordinary situation that required a very rapid mobilization.
Although many in the international aid community dismiss the criticisms as unfounded and irresponsible, others acknowledge that there may be a problem. Denny Guzzi runs Dutch Médecins Sans Frontières in Ethiopia.
My question mark would be more on the scope of the problem or the scope of the famine, because without any doubt, there was famine in some areas of Ethiopia. What was the scope of the problem in all areas of Ethiopia? This is where the question mark is, and this is where there might have been exaggeration. Now, the way it was managed by the medias, the ways that it was managed by all type of organizations, let's say that the door was open to take opportunity to make it maybe a little bit larger than it was in reality.
Regardless of the risks of donor fatigue and the rights and wrongs of the agency's publicity campaigns, some Ethiopians are beginning to question whether they and their nation should be projected as a collective of disaster-prone victims. Lulit Gabre Mikael is editor-in-chief of the leading Ethiopian daily newspaper, The Daily Monitor, in Addis Ababa.
Most NGOs get their money out of poverty and misfortune that is happening in Africa. They hype it up. It's part of the reality. It is degrading, but the answer lies in Ethiopia, because it is up to Ethiopians to get their country out of the misery it is in. Ethiopians have to turn their image and their history around. Although it is degrading, it's mainly up to us. Ethiopia is a very peaceful country. It's not what the Western media makes it out to be.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Medical residents and interns routinely work extremely long hours, 80 to 100 hours or more a week, often on 36-hour shifts, and they work for relatively little pay. In Los Angeles, a movement to unionize residents and interns helped ease some of those pressures. But the near collapse of county health care systems has built those demands back up. Reporter Robin Yurovich visited one of California's busiest hospitals to see what life is like for doctors in training. At the county hospital in East Los Angeles, most of the patients, the majority of whom are uninsured, come through this emergency room. On a Monday night, all the beds are full and the ER is jammed with patients.
About a dozen patients are being treated on gurneys in open areas. Doctors examine one woman who's swallowed a razor blade, and police come through the waiting area searching for a suspect.
The patient Zapata is needed in CT.
Some patients will stay here for hours, even overnight, until a bed opens up.
Can we move that guy out? 7841. I don't think it's empty yet. Do one more thing. Call pulmonary.
On this night, third-year resident Dr. Dharani Patel is assigned to what's called med consult. Her job is to juggle the patient load so stable patients can be released and the sickest ones admitted. The toughest part is finding beds in intensive care areas.
We still don't have any beds open, so the resident called me for the bed. I don't have one. She's now going to call the pulmonary critical care section of medicine to see whether they have beds. I doubt that they do. I have to go back and reevaluate everyone, see who's available, who can be bumped out of the CMA, the closely monitored area.
The patient is one of 2.7 million uninsured people in Los Angeles County. He has advanced liver disease, but because he has no health insurance, hasn't sought treatment until now. Beds are at a premium here because there aren't enough nurses to staff them. When the county health department faced financial collapse nearly 5 years ago, county officials decided to fill just one of every three vacant positions. What's happened since is a massive staffing shortage that puts an extra burden on residents, says Dr. Alexis Anvikar.
The interns and residents are having to work 80 to 120 hours every week because we have to help do the job of the clerks, the secretaries, the nurses, the medical techs, the lab techs, and the phlebotomists.
The Accreditation Agency on Medical Education has cited the hospital because it forces doctors to do too much work unrelated to their educations. And resident Patel says staff physicians themselves are speaking out.
We've just been so understaffed that our patient care has been compromised. The physicians have really seen that, and they really, several of the physicians, they've decided, you know, enough is enough. If we don't speak about it, then no one else is going to speak about it.
This fall, the County Board of Supervisors ordered a report on the hours and working conditions of residents due out early next year. The residents' union just finished contract talks. The agreement limits all-night on-call shifts to once every 3 nights. That's particularly important at a place like the county hospital because it's so busy that doctors on call rarely get any sleep. At times, that puts patients at risk. And residents, too, says Dr. Saeed Sadeghi.
The most dangerous thing is that never in my life I would doze off driving, and I have dozed off driving often. Fortunately, I've never gotten into an accident, fortunately, but others have.
Other overtired residents have stuck themselves with potentially contaminated needles during procedures. Dr. Ed Wong is the interim director of medical education. He says the interns and residents have legitimate concerns, especially about non-physician work they have to do.
We underwent a major reduction in force in 1995, and we've not recovered from that. I think that this has, to an extent, adversely affected the quality of the education, in part because then they're taken away from other activities that are more meaningful to their learning to practice the medical specialty, and also by virtue of the fact that then the residents are tired and are spending a lot of time doing things that they really really not an inherent part of the physician's role in taking care of patients.
Still, Wong says pressure on everyone at the hospital will increase. The county health department has said it will cut staff by another 10% by the year 2005. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robin Yurovich in Los Angeles.
500 supporters of Pacifica Radio's New York station, WBAI, gathered outside the law offices of Epstein, Becker, and Green in Manhattan on Wednesday evening for the second major demonstration since WBAI general manager Valerie Van Isler was dismissed from her position by Pacifica. The demonstration targeted Pacifica board member John Murdoch, who works for Epstein, Becker, and Green, a corporate law firm which claims to specialize in maintaining union-free workplaces. As Miranda Kennedy reports, the listeners say they're protesting the rightward political shift of the Pacifica network.
We're a station,
not a corporation!
We're a station,
not a corporation!
We're a station,
not a corporation!
One, two, three, four! Murdoch is a corporate whore! One, two, three, four!
Concerned friends of WBAI are targeting this anti-union law firm because new Pacifica National Board member John Murdoch works at the firm, and they say he represents an undemocratic shift within the Pacifica National Board. Murdoch's firm is currently representing the Pacifica Foundation in several lawsuits filed by listeners and local advisory board members against Pacifica. New York State Senator Tom Duane told the crowd that he and other elected officials had written to Pacifica Executive Director Bessie Wash in protest of the removal of Valerie Van Isler. He said he'll introduce a resolution for WBAI's autonomy in the city council.
Pacifica stepped in and fired the general manager without any consultation at all. That takes away workers' rights, and that is wrong. Give us back the People's Network. Give us back Pacifica. Give us back the board, and give us back WBAI. This one is for John Murdoch. What's so disgusting? Union busting. What's disgusting?
Union
What's disgusting?
Union
What's disgusting?
Speakers at the rally demanded home rule for WBAI, saying it is a vital community resource whose political content must not be watered down or turned to soft jazz. WBAI producers and listeners say that the removal of Van Isler is not the first, but the most recent assault on the autonomy of WBAI and other Pacifica stations. They say Pacifica has not adhered to the foundation's bylaws and that it also does not protect its workers. WBAI news reporter Eileen Sutton says this is just the latest in a string of hostile actions by Pacifica.
George Ryder was a producer in Houston who was recently summarily fired because he protested in support of Amy. Do we think this is a crisis from outside the station? Hell yes!
Hell yes!
The striking reporters struck over issues of censorship. It's been one of the most important acts of resistance in the history of this struggle over the last 5 years.
Kamau Kalfani is a longtime listener and producer at WBAI.
I started listening to WBAI around 1984 with a gentleman named Alan Bozak making an appeal on the issue of South Africa. I was so moved that I took that tape, I recorded, and went door to door with the information. Is it worth saving?
Yeah!
Is it worth saving?
Yeah!
We will not be moved.
Last week, Pacifica Foundation announced it had begun a national search for a new WBAI station manager, but Van Isler says she will refuse to surrender her position come her last day, December 31st of this year. Listeners plan to hold a continuous vigil at the station from December 27th through January 2nd to protect the station.
We're a station,
not a corporation!
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Miranda Kennedy in New York.
Station,
not a corporation!
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. For more information on the strike, check out our website at www.savepacifica.net /strike. I'm Matt Martin. Tune in again next week.